You're listening to Justice Radio on WMPG with Rob Ruffner from the Maine Incident Defense Center. And today we're speaking with Toby Johnro from the Aroostook County Public Defender's Office. So today we're joined by Toby Johnro, who I've known for well over 20 years since practicing in Maine. I'll let Toby introduce himself and not only talk about his current position, but sort of how he got here to be in terms of doing defense and then being the district defender for Aroostook County.
Thanks, Rob. So I've been practicing since 2009. I had a brief stint practicing in York County. I was working in the drug court while I was waiting to pass the bar down in York County. That was kind of my first entry into the criminal defense world. I was a case manager for the drug court down there. I worked with folks who had been participating in that court, and it was a great experience. So really enjoyed it. When I passed the bar, I hung a shingle in Biddeford for a hot minute. Then we moved to Fort Kent, I think within a few months. It was my wife and our then infant and myself. And I hung a shingle in Fort Kent doing a general practice. And back then, this was before MCILS really had fully formed. I came up here right on the cusp of that. So all of the changes hadn't quite hit yet. I remember when I came up here, I actually called you, Rob, because there was no LOD walk-in in Aroostook County. And I asked you what I needed to do. So you told me what to do. And I did my first LOD in Fort Kent when I moved up here.
So I know that I'm interrupting your introduction, but for our international listeners and for listeners from away that don't know where and what Aroostook County is like, can you describe Aroostook County and how that's sort of unique compared to even the rest of Maine?
So Aroostook County is the largest county in Maine. I think it's bigger than most of New England. I am in the northernmost part of it. We're bordering Canada. In fact, the hills behind me are Canadian hills. We're right on the river, the St. John River, which divides the United States and Canada here in the northernmost part of Maine. Aroostook County is a very, like as I said, a very large county. I'm in Fort Kent, which isn't the end of the road, but I can see it. Comprised of a handful of towns. I think Aroostook County is the fifth largest county population-wise. There's not a lot of huge population density because the size spread out over all of the giant county. We end up being a larger county than I think most people think. We have a lot of mid-sized communities. I mean, Fort Kent's a town I live in. We're about between 3,000 and 4,000 people. Madawaska is about the same. Caribou's bigger. Presque Isle, Holton, and then there's a number of little towns in between. It's a series of small communities kind of tied together. There's no large population center. I mean, Presque Isle is the largest town we have. And it's by no means, I mean, it's a city technically, but it's not a large city. It's a very small one. And so there's a lot of space in between. A lot of travel between places. Aroostook County also has four courthouses, two superior courthouses, which makes it unusual. Generally, each county has one superior court. Aroostook County's got two. They have one in Holton, one in Caribou.
You have five courthouses?
Let's see. We got Fort Kent, Caribou, Presque Isle, Holton. Oh, Madawaska. I'm sorry. And I go to Madawaska. I have no reason to go to Madawaska. Madawaska is more of a part of the Fort Kent court, because if Madawaska is open, Fort Kent courthouse is closed. The two towns are about half an hour for each other, Fort Kent and Madawaska.
That's because the light switch only works if it's turned up. The lights are on in Madawaska, and when they turn them off there, they go back on in Fort Kent, right?
Exactly. The thing is, it has a lot to do with the geography, because, you know, Fort Kent and Madawaska are the two towns on the two largest towns on the northern border against the St. John River. And there are towns east of Madawaska and west of Fort Kent that really would have a very long distance to go if they had to access a court, if they had to go to the other courthouse. So it ensures that basically nobody's driving more than half an hour to court, which I can get behind. Most of our clients have a hard time with transportation. So I think a half an hour to court is doable for most folks.
And so in terms of large, it's the size of Connecticut and Rhode Island combined geography wise. I think it's the largest county east of the Mississippi. In terms of the economics, in terms of that demographic, compared to the rest of Maine, certainly southern Maine, is there a big difference in terms of
the economics are different. I mean, historically, we've been largely a agricultural county. So we produce wood products and potatoes and agricultural products like that. prior to, when I was growing up here, we had a booming military economy as well. And we lost that when I was, I think, in high school, like 93, they lost the Air Force Base. That got shipped down below the Mason-Dixon. That was a huge blow to the region. And I don't think we, I mean, I still think we're recovering from that. We lost a lot of folks. A lot of people moved away. It's hard to put it in terms that make sense, but because I don't know the raw numbers, but I know, growing up, we were in a school that was considered a Class B school for sports. We're now a Class C or D school in Fort Kent. So there's been a significant amount of out-migration. I think Arista County has always been particularly hard hit by kind of our traditional extractive economy, where we take all the value and we leave nothing behind and then complain about why are these people so poor. You can really see it here in a way that I think it's a little more hidden than the rest of the state. I think every industry is ultimately extractive. You take as much value as you can from your workers and from the land, you leave a mess and you move on to the next place. So I think here it's because it's so visible, you can see it. It's right there.
So I apologize for interrupting your introduction, but you had just sort of talked about hanging your shingle in Arista County and getting involved with starting up or being a catalyst for the court starting up a Lawyer of the Day program in the first place. So
I was always interested in doing criminal work. I went to Maine Law and I worked in the Cumberland Legal Aid Clinic, and I worked with Jim Burke, who really helped kind of spur that interest. So when I came up here, I didn't know if I was going to have any work because I basically packed the van and moved up with the family. So this was back before the rosters and before there was any minimum requirements. And I went to the superior, I called one of the judges in the judge in Fort Kent, Judge Daigle. And I asked him, if I moved up here, is there going to be any work for me? And his answer was, I've got a stack of cases right now that I need to get to somebody. So I moved up, I went to the Caribou Superior Courthouse, and I didn't know I had to talk to a clerk. I didn't know what I had to do. So I chatted with a judge who I'd known from when I grew up here. And he, as I was walking out the door, the clerk chased me out the door with a stack of cases and asked me to look at them and decide which ones I wanted. And I took, those are my first court appointments. I picked them in the parking lot of Caribou Superior Court. So it was, and it was a steep learning curve. I mean, I didn't take a lot of cases, but I took a handful of cases that, I mean, today I wouldn't have been qualified for. Looking back on them, I was very fortunate because I had a group of people who I could call and ask for help, who mentored me through it down on the coast. I think I called Jonathan Handelman at least twice a week to ask him what to do. So, I mean, there was a safety net there. I've never been embarrassed to say I don't know. And I said, I don't know a lot that first year. And I had a lot of really great lawyers assist me, people who helped me learn what I needed to do, taught me what to ask for, how to ask for it. I stole a lot of letters. I stole a lot of motions. And I had to get up to speed pretty quickly. But it was that was how I started my practice in Northern Maine, was with primarily criminal work. As time went on, I was approached by a wonderful paralegal who was looking to move back to the Valley and back to Arista County's makeup. The northern part's called the Valley, St. John Valley, predominantly French Catholic. The up and down part that goes north to south on the side, that's predominantly, Anglo. It's a different, culturally there's a difference there. The Valley tends to, was historically French speaking. And, my assistant wanted to finish her career in a place where she could speak French at work. So she called and asked me to work with her if she could work with me. And I hired her, and she worked with me for my entire 14 years that my office was open in Fort Kent. And she was fantastic. Trina Spooner, I was the best thing that ever happened to me professionally, because she kept me in line. She came into the office and had an extensive, work history with, probate and real estate. So because it's rural Maine, you do a general practice. So I ended up doing a lot of those other things, dabbled in family matters, but always kept criminal on my plate. It was something that was important to me. And it was something that as time went on and I built my practice, it didn't pay particularly well. So back when it was, what, $50 an hour? And even at that time, my office, I was billing $150 an hour. But it was important to me because there was not a whole lot of people doing it. And it was something I was passionate about. And I kind of, the way I looked at it is I used my real estate and other parts of my practice to kind of subsidize my doing what, I mean, at the time, criminal work was effectively low bono. That was, and then noticing that there was a dearth of attorneys in Northern Maine, I started working with, I've been talking to Deirdre Smith since I came back here at Maine Law. She was,
She one of the clinical professors?
She was more than a clinical professor. She was the head of the clinic.
Okay.
I don't remember what the title was, but she was in charge. Deirdre was wonderful. And she's now, I think, the LP. And we've been trying to get some sort of pipeline for young attorneys to come to rural Maine. So I started working with Deirdre on that. We pushed and we tried, and getting the law school to agree to allow people to get their education remotely was very difficult until 2020, when all of a sudden remote education became easy because everything was remote. So it really, I mean, a lot of bad things happened with COVID. There was the silver lining was that we were able to kind of conceptualize remote learning for lawyers to come to rural Maine. So I was really passionate about that. Help open shop up here. Molly Butler Bailey was still at the clinic at the time. And Deirdre was part of what got this thing going. And before she left the clinic, we opened the clinic. I worked there for about a year. We got our first clinical students into Worcester County, and they were doing criminal work, which was fantastic. We had them in doing LOD, Lawyer of the Day, and that was really good work. Really couldn't, it was Emma Pooler and Ryan Fowler were the first two students. They were fantastic. And then I got a call from Justin Andrus saying that they had this opening for the rural defender unit. They needed a district defender.
At that time, Justin was the interim, or maybe he was past the interim stage.
He was still the interim.
Interim executive director. Yeah. For the commission.
Yeah. And so I applied for the position for various reasons. And the prospect of working with attorneys and trying to help build them up, provide support, that's the thing that's appealing to me and was appealing to me. So I applied for the position, and I was offered the position, which was fantastic. I took over the rural defender unit, which I don't know if that was it was an interesting notion. Basically a group of itinerant roving lawyers around the state trying to fill in gaps, which, you know, looking back on it, I suppose on some level it made sense because the idea was that the problems were only in rural Maine, but we found out shortly that that was not the case. The problems were statewide. It's just we didn't really have a handle on them. It's like I was saying about some of these structural problems we tend to see, I think, in rural areas before we see them in urban areas because you can have more cover.
And I think I was there when the Rural Defender Unit was born in the legislature, and it was born out of essentially the legislature and the governor not wanting to open traditional public defender offices, and Justin being very forthright when asked a question of, well, what else could you use? What else, you know, besides everything you're asking for? And Justin, not incorrectly, said, well, I certainly could, it would be great if I had roving attorneys that I could plug into gaps. And I saw the legislators' eyes light up, and they latched on to that. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the, unfortunately, a roadblock to getting traditional offices up and running sooner, because they sort of, for whatever reason, thought, well, let's do this, and perhaps this will be enough. And you're right, you know, not seeing the writing on the wall that this isn't just a rural problem, and it's much bigger than, was it 6 attorneys or 5 with you?
5.
You know, would ever be able to, you know, it's a much bigger leak in the dam than would ever be plugged by the 5 of you. So,
yeah. And you know, I'm grateful it was started because it ended up turning into something different. Right. But I know those. So I supervised the RDU for a year before I shifted over to the Aristic Defender Unit. And in that year, it was hard. I mean, for these young attorneys, they were, I mean, say young, they're younger than me. It was a lot to expect people to run all over the state like that. And, you know, you really become acutely aware of how little law has to do with the practice of law when you're going from courthouse to courthouse watching local practice. And, you know, I tell this joke, you know, I joke about this, that, you know, we learn in law school that, you know, you have your treaties, and then you have the Constitution, and then you have your statutes, and then you have your rules, and then you have your local norms. And there's a hierarchy there from most important to least important. It's actually completely inverted. Local norms end up kind of dictating whether or not you can file motions, what the Constitution means. I mean, it was a real wake up call for me on how incongruent things were from court to court, from county to county, from court to court. you know, and you have to adapt. And I think we also have to, we have a role to help teach and point out, like, hey, that's, you know, I know that's how you've always done it, but maybe that's not right.
You're listening to Justice Radio with Rob Ruffner, and we're speaking with Toby Johnrow. I have found that that can be an interesting dance, a delicate process of raising that with the institutions that you are appearing in front of, judges and clerks, in terms of asking them to do things differently. As you know, I've been spending much more time in Aroostook County virtually than I thought I was going to when I got involved mid-February with the Lawyer of the Day process there. But, you know, I've done it all over the state in the last almost 3 years now, of doing almost exclusively or primarily Lawyer of the Day. And I've got, apparently, you know, 2 decades of experience as doing indigent defense when I'm broaching these topics with clerks and judges and everything. I met your crew when they were first coming together, when they were hired in the RDU, and I was very impressed. I mean, it was exciting. You could just tell the group was exciting and everything. But there were a couple of folks that were very at the very beginning of their career, and then some more experienced people, but were coming over from maybe not criminal practice, but I think Pine Tree Legal, you know, the civil legal aid side and everything. How did you facilitate that teaching, that education, or that advocacy, even, you know, structural advocacy, I suppose, could not just individual cases, but asking for things to be done differently across cases? Did it vary whether it was you assisting the attorneys or the attorneys on their own primarily, or, you know, how did you manage that?
I'm a big fan of collaboration. This isn't a top-down organization as far as I'm concerned. I think it's very dangerous to, anything can happen in the courtroom. And the great way to break down the attorneys you work with, their agency, is to make them continually doubt themselves. They're already going to do that. So letting them explore the bounds of these issues themselves and help problem solve together is how we handle it. I mean, we're currently dealing with a cultural problem around discovery. Okay. We don't get evidence in a timely manner, and things are often either inadvertently or intentionally, I don't know, things, we don't get them. We don't get certain police reports. We don't get things we're entitled to. So when I started way back when I had my first few cases, it was not unusual. One of my first jury trials, I walked into court and it was an OUI refusal. And I'd read everything and I'd asked for my discovery as we used to. And I got a report. My guy refused to blow into the machine or whatever. And jury's impaneled. They're coming up the stairs and a DVD hits the desk. And it's a video of my guy in the intox screening room. Absolutely automatic discovery, right? The judge at the time looked at me and said, well, I'll give you 20 minutes to watch the video. The jury's here. We're having this trial today. That was the culture in Aroostook County around missing discoveries. Basically, there was no downside for the state to withhold it or to not give it to you. So they wouldn't. We're having to build a lot there. So what's happened is the entire team has recognized these problems, and we're working together on tactics on how to extract that information and how to kind of get everybody in line. So, you know, that we've had Hillary Knight, who used to be with our unit, is now down in Kennebec County, and she's had some some solid wins. And Mackenzie DeVoe has litigated some of these issues for the RDU. She's still with us, and she's done some great work with that. They're the ones on the ground. They're the ones doing the fighting. We talk amongst each other and figure out how we want to strategize, but ultimately they're the ones fighting the fight.
So I want to talk a little bit about, in the time we have left for today, because I think perhaps we should maybe talk again about poverty and the geography and how, you know, rural Maine, how, you know, what's that do to justice for another, do that another time, the different ways it affects things. But in terms of, you mentioned a couple of impediments or inefficiencies with the rural defender units in terms of all over the state was one of them. You know, what do you think were some other issues compared to a traditional brick and mortar, meaning in one county with, you know, an actual office and support staff? And what are the difficulties are you having? Because now you're in the Arusa County Public Defender's Office. What are the strengths and challenges you're seeing there? So first finish up with the RDU and then talk about your new gig.
Well, I mean, those two things really segue well together, because you're the RDU, I mean, folks were practicing under their cars with, you know, driving to the places they need to be all over the state. The time in the car alone was a huge impediment. The presumption that we'd be able to, you know, do dictation or make phone calls while in the car in a place where, you know, your cell service is nominal at best and not consistent. So you can't even have a phone call. I mean, if I have to go to Caribou for court, I'm not making any phone calls because there's no consistent service for long enough to have a phone call last more than 3 minutes. I think another thing is like you said, the brick and mortar, there is something to be said about a space, right? A place to go and unload your paperwork, your bags, and also I think the psychological baggage, right? Being able to place a place to check it, you know? I mean, I think that was a huge impediment, just not having a place to unload those things that we're carrying as lawyers, just the awful things we've seen, all these things, like a place to kind of come together. We do it virtually, but I think there's something to be said for doing stuff like that in person. I think the other thing is just infrastructure. You know, everything is so difficult when you're doing it out of your car. You need a photocopy. Well, that's going to be rough because you've got this tiny little photo scanner thing that works half the time. You want to print something? Well, you're out of ink. Good luck. There's not a Staples for another 100 miles. It's the technological piece. We have access to so many things, but it assumes they're going to work properly. And I have found that for the most part, nothing ever seems to work properly. And that's been that. I mean, it was really stressful. I mean, we were lucky. It was one day we were in court in Caribou, and I think Kenzie had a case, and I was observing, and she needed something printed, and her printer just wasn't working. It just decided not to work. And luckily, there was a lawyer in Caribou who does primarily civil work, who I was able to call, and he let us print stuff on his printer, which was fantastic. But like that's the sort of thing that really gets in your way. As far as what the brick and mortar offices bring, they bring a sense of stability. I think they will bring a legitimacy to the public defender's offices, and I hope for the field too. I mean, I think there's a very unfortunate notion that public defense, that the criminal defense lawyers are less than. And I disagree completely, but we're not the ones in the big fancy buildings in Portland, you know, with Audis in the parking that look like somebody dropped a bag of Skittles. We're not those people. And that's okay. We're something different. I think legitimacy helps. I think respect will come from having those offices. I think we also, one of the benefits of the RDU that carries over into these individual offices is the ability to mount concerted campaigns against or in favor of things. Prior to the creation of these offices, we had a bunch of spirited public defenders, okay, friends of mine. But they were like a pack of cats. They couldn't make a sustained attack on anything because they'd fight, you know, they'd be fighting amongst each other over this side or the other and disagreeing on how to do things. This way we can actually target issues that we think need to be targeted and really put the energy towards making changes through litigation. And I think that's one of the benefits. That's the thing I'm most looking forward to, is being able to have a group of people saying, we're going to go after bail, right? There's a problem with bail. We're going to focus our energy on bail. There's a problem with discovery. We're going to focus our problem on discovery. There's a problem with sentencing. We can focus all our attention on sentencing and really hammering in on those things. And I think that's what these offices are going to bring that we haven't had yet.
How big is your office going to be when it's fully staffed, attorney wise and your support staff wise?
Four attorneys that aren't me, paralegal, a paralegal slash office manager, an investigator. That's it.
And the space they're working on to locate you is in.
Caribou.
I think that there's a lot to talk about that we won't have time for this episode. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. But hopefully we can talk a little bit more about how you envision your office that you're growing, building from the ground up, and how it's going to impact and improve things for your clients in general, but also clients specifically in your location in a very large county with five different courthouses. And you mentioned that no one has to go half. There's a courthouse within a half an hour for everybody, unless you live in Fort Kent and your case is in Holton,
Yeah,
then you're
exactly.
SOL.
And that, yeah.
But
And there's always talk of creating like a another, like they have in Bangor and Biddeford, a fortress of justice somewhere in Arista County, which it would be great to have updated facilities. So their facilities are old.
right.
But the downside is if the expectation is that somebody from Allegash, who's half an hour or more than half an hour west of Fort Kent and can't even get to 161 to drive south to Caribou, till they get to Fort Kent. So they're 40 minutes to Fort Kent and they gotta drive south an hour. And they're probably going for an OAS, an operating after suspension. I mean, it's almost,
Punishment, even if they're found not guilty, just trying to get there.
well, yeah, it's absurdity. And I think there's been a lot of talk about efficiency, and it's efficiency is generally just corners cut where it doesn't matter for people who don't matter. That's what we got to watch out for. I mean, the bulk of the folks we see through, it's not as bad since they changed the rules and the laws around OASs, but there was a time where it felt like everybody in court was there for an OAS.
I think there's a lot to talk about. I appreciate you taking the time, Toby. And I hopefully we can talk again more about your office, your vision for it, and then how you think it's going to, interact with the clients, like I said, in terms of the difference it's going to make compared to, the herd of cats slash defenders on their own. And you touched on a couple of those. But I think that we're probably over our time. Thank you for listening to Justice Radio. Tune in next time when we interview another interesting guest. And a big thank you to Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode of our series.